May it please the court. Not familiar. I see some switches here. Is there something I'm supposed to switch?
No, the green light will turn to yellow when it's 5 minutes left, and you can adjust the podium if you like.
Thanks.
Make yourself happy.
My name is Corey Zerbal. I represent PFW, Inc. We're here today. My client is appealing two rulings from the trial court. The first deals with the Interstate Land Sales Full Disclosure Act, which I'd like to refer to this afternoon as ILSA so that we're all on the same page. The second deals with the Department of Regulatory Administration Division of Real Estate Regulations and a motion to vacate that was denied by the trial court. I'd like to begin with addressing the ILSA portion of the appeal. In the trial court, one of the main issues was whether or not ILSA applied to the real estate transaction involved in the underlying litigation. ILSA is a consumer protection scheme that is designed to protect purchasers of real estate across state borders under certain circumstances, and particularly when there is the sale of a lot. That's the general application of the rule when there's a sale of a lot involving interstate trade. There are exceptions under ILSA for real estate developments that have various levels of property being sold, various lots, 25, 100. There are various breakdowns, and depending on where you fall, you're exempted from different portions of the statutory scheme. In this case, the trial court ruled that the interest being conveyed in the underlying real estate transaction was not a lot, and that therefore ILSA didn't apply at all. And we think that that ruling was an error. The definition of lot.
Let me just be clarified here. If, for example, it had mattered that there were, say, I understand there are 27 units. 26 units in this thing. But would the court have determined that there were at least 26 lots in the building, or at least a lot, or was it?
Actually, the court didn't know. Given the court's ruling, even the 26 units would not have been a lot.
I see.
And that the
just that the nature of the interest conveyed here wasn't a lot at all.
Correct. Okay. That is the overall ruling of the court, the effect of the lower court's ruling.
Mr. Zerbal, because I understand your position, you're saying that there should have been 8 lots defined by the court for each unit.
That's correct, yes. That each interest being transferred by the real estate purchase contract constituted a lot. And the statutory scheme doesn't define lot in and of itself. However, HUD, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, has issued regulations that provide some guidance as to what a lot means. And yet their definition is that a lot means any portion, piece, division, unit, or undivided interest in land located in any state or foreign country, if the interest includes the right to exclusive use of a specific portion of the land. That's the exact language of the CFR citation. That's 24 CFR section 1710.1. And when you look at the interest conveyed, you have to go to the contract for sale in this case. And if you go to the contract, you'll see that what was to be conveyed was a 1/8 undivided fee simple interest in a specific unit, in this case unit F7, in the Residences of Little Nell subdivision. If you stop the analysis right there, I think it's clear that that fits into the definition of a lot that I just read to you. Any portion, it's a 1/8 portion, that's a portion. Piece or division, it's a undivided interest. We have an undivided interest in land. A condominium project is unequivocally been found to be real estate throughout the courts. Located in any state or foreign country, we've got that. And so that much of it, there doesn't seem to be any controversy over it. I think the 1/8 undivided interest in fee simple constitutes a lot. And then the second half of the regulation says, if the interest includes the right to exclusive use of a specific portion of the land. Now, if you look at the contract, it's a fee simple interest. And fee simple is the most complete bundle of rights that you can get when you purchase real estate, which by definition includes the right to exclude others. That's included in a fee simple interest. And a specific portion of the land, the contract defines unit F7. And that's all that's in the contract.
But Mr. Zerber, Judge Boyd found that there wasn't really a right to exclusive use of the unit, because any unit owner, whether it's PFW or anybody else, didn't have a right to use that specific unit because it depended on the availability of units at any given time.
But that's what I think the court erred. I don't think that's exactly what the court found. But what the court found is the contract also bound the purchasers to agree to be bound by the HOA rules, just like any condominium buyer is required to do in Colorado. Under the particular condominium rules and regulations that were in place for this development, there was a rotating reservation system. And under the rotating reservation system, each owner was guaranteed to 2 weeks use in the summer and 2 weeks use in the fall. That was guaranteed. That was regardless of availability.
It was guaranteed, but not for a specific unit. Isn't that correct?
Not for a specific unit, but for a specific type of unit. Within the development, not only were there 26 residential units, of those 26, there was a certain number that were four-bedroom units and a certain number that were three-bedroom units, but there were also affordable housing units that aren't included in those 26, and hotel units, flat-out ordinary hotel units like you would think of in the ordinary definition of hotel, that were separate and apart from the 26 residential units. They were guaranteed only the right to use a like unit. So if they were purchasing a three-bedroom unit, or in our case, a four-bedroom unit, they had the right to use a four-bedroom unit, but not a three-bedroom. They couldn't use an affordable housing unit if it was available. They couldn't use a hotel unit if it was available.
And so when they purchased a three-bedroom unit, did they purchase 1/8 interest in a specific three-bedroom unit, or was it?
It was in a specific three-bedroom unit, and they got a deed to that unit.
Okay, so
a
1/8 interest in, say,
a mortgage on that unit.
In unit like 1-1A or whatever it is.
Absolutely.
Okay,
yeah.
Interesting.
And so our position is that this secondary rotating reservation system that the HOA employs is a secondary agreement. It's not part of the interest that ILSA is designed to cover. ILSA is designed to cover the interest being conveyed in the contract, and that's the fee simple 1/8 interest unit. The agreement to enter into the HOA rules is a side agreement, a separate agreement, apart and above the interest being transferred. And the reason I say that is the HOA rules and regulations are mutable. They can change. At the time that this took place, the declarant, the developer, had not transferred control of the HOA over to the HOA itself. When enough units are sold, then it gets transferred, but the HOA can vote to change that. So that rotating reservation system can change. The HOA could vote to disband, and each owner would then still have their 1/8 interest in that particular unit. They're just agreeing on how they're going to have access to it for things such as cleaning purposes. So when they show up, they know they have a clean unit available.
Mr. Zerber, don't we have to look at the circumstances as they obtained at the time that PFW purchased the unit, or PFW's predecessor purchased the unit?
Well, I think you can look at those, but the fact that they change, I think ILSA as a consumer protection scheme needs to be looked at and applied liberally in favor of coverage. And so I think you need to look at the interest that's being transferred, the fee simple 1/8 interest, and the secondary agreement. There's nothing in ILSA that says it applies to private contracts between individuals other than the transfer of real estate, which is what the HOA documents are. So I understand your point is, how do you look at that as it's set in time? But ILSA also applies to the whole development. And since those, they didn't change in this case, but they're capable of changing, is it, you know, I think you have to look at it as a development as a whole and not on a piece-by-piece basis. Does this apply to the residents of Little Nell? And not, does it, you know, it could change day-to-day if the HOA or the declarant wanted to change those rules. And I think because of that, the HOA document shouldn't be included in that analysis. But even if you do include them, I think it's still covered by ILSA. And that's because they did get the exclusive right to use a specific portion of the land, in my case, a four-bedroom unit as opposed to a three-bedroom unit. That's a specific portion of the land. They had a guaranteed right to use it for 2 weeks in the summer, 2 weeks in the winter. And when they were using it, once they were in there, they had the right to exclude others. They couldn't come in and say, you've got to move out. We're going to let other people stay in here.
Mr. Zerbeck, how does your argument square with the HUD guidelines, which are a little bit more specific than the HUD regulations because they refer to use of a specific designated lot?
I don't think that's exactly what the HUD guidelines say. The language of the HUD guidelines is specific portion of the land. I realize that RLN used the language specific portion of the lot in their brief, but I searched the HUD guidelines and couldn't find that definition that they put in quotes in the brief anywhere within the HUD guidelines. I think they've misquoted them.
Well, what my understanding is that the guidelines say that, that the term lot applies to the sale of a condominium or a cooperative unit or a campsite as well as a traditional lot. If the purchaser of an undivided interest or a membership has exclusive repeated use or possession of a specific designated lot, even for a portion of the year, a lot as defined by the regulations exists. So, and I understand you to be saying you didn't find that language in the guidelines.
I don't think that's the exact order that Arlen quoted it in. I use an electronic search. I had other people in my office use it. We couldn't find it. But I think that is an example, and the guidelines state in the beginning of them that examples are stated, but they're not exclusive. If you have that, you definitely have a lot, but that is not the only definition of a lot that there is. And the guidelines and ILSA have, over the years, before condominiums, there was just dirt sales, typical traditional subdivisions, and that's what ILSA applied to. Then we created condominiums, and that's what ILSA applied to. Now we've created fractional interests, and the developers are saying, we don't have to comply with ILSA. All we have to do is create a rotating reservation system that we can change at any time after we start this thing, and we don't have to meet the really not burdensome requirements of ILSA. They're not that burdensome, but they do provide some protection to the consumer. And I think if you accept RLN's position on it, they're saying we don't have to do that. We found a sneaky way around it. The second portion of my argument has to do with the ILSA claims underneath were separated from non-ILSA claims, and the non-ILSA claims were arbitrated. We believe that RLN did not have the ability to enforce the contract with the arbitration provision in it, and that they misled my client and the underlying court by sending us a letter and filing a motion to compel arbitration when they didn't have the right to enforce that contract. The reason they didn't have the right to enforce the contract is they didn't have a registration at the time they entered into the contract. Through the underlying proceedings, they continually produced proof of a license, but they never produced proof of having a registration prior to entering into the contract. And there's a difference between a license and a registration. I think without the registration, the contract was unenforceable. They didn't have the right to do it. If we had known that, if they hadn't told us that they had the right by sending a letter and filing a motion to compel, we would not have gone through with the arbitration. And our position is that the arbitration itself was then therefore procured by fraud. RLN has said in their response that they have a strict interpretation of when an arbitration can be vacated, and they attempt to argue that it's only when the arbitrator commits fraud or does something unduly. And I don't think that's the right interpretation, I think if the arbitration was procured by fraud, whether it was the one of the parties involved or the arbitrator, then the courts have the power to set it aside.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Jeff Lippa. With me at council table is David Goldberg, and together we represent the appellee, the residences at Little Nell Development, LLC. Your Honor, this is a case about buyer's remorse. PFW entered into a pre-construction contract to purchase a fractional interest in the residences at Little Nell. When the markets declined in 2008, PFW sought any and every way possible to avoid its responsibilities under that contract, not because the residences project wasn't built, and not because it wasn't as advertised, but rather simply because the value of PFW's $3 million fractional interest that they bought at the peak of the market had, like most real estate in 2008, gone down significantly. And that's not just argument, that is what the arbitrator found in this case in 2010. It found that PFW had breached its obligations under the party's contract. The arbitrator also denied a myriad of other claims asserted by PFW and awarded the disputed earnest money to our client, the residences at Little Nell. Next, PFW asserted an ILSA claim in the district court. And as the 11th Circuit has recently noted in the Stein case, in the wake of the burst of the housing bubble, the Interstate Land Sales Full Disclosure Act has become an increasingly popular means of channeling buyer's remorse into a legal defense. That legal defense was rejected by Judge Boyd in the district court in this case, holding that the residences are exempt from application of the act because they contain fewer than 100 lots. Now PFW claims both that the arbitration award was procured by fraud and should be vacated, and that the district court's interpretation of ILSA was incorrect. PFW's argument with respect to ILSA is a matter of first impression, but we think it's flawed for the following three reasons. First, as Mr. Zerbaugh indicated, the case turns on a definition of lot, and all of the authorities establish that the definition of lot requires a two-prong test or analysis. It's not simply that every interest in real estate is a lot, but instead also requires exclusivity. So second, in this case, the district court found there was no exclusivity, and therefore that PFW failed the second prong of the definition of a lot. Finally, PFW's argument to this court that it has exclusive use of a unit type is not what is required by the regulations or the guidelines, and even if it were, would result in the project having only two lots, the three-bedroom unit type and the four-bedroom unit type. And if there were only two lots, then the district court's conclusion that there were fewer than 100 lots would still apply.
Mr. Lippa, what is your response to Mr. Zerbeck's argument that the purchase agreement should be the main document or the only document that we look at, and that transferred a fee simple interest in a specific unit?
Your Honor, the purchase contract did convey a fee simple interest in a certain unit. However, I disagree with Mr. Zerba's characterization of the contract, because in that contract, in paragraph 2B, for example, it specifically says that what you are buying is a fractional unit, and that is a defined term, and the contract says it's defined as it's defined in the declaration. And the declaration is a recorded document that says all interests purchase at the residences of Little Nell must be submitted into this fractional rotating reservation system. So I don't think you can have it both ways, Your Honor, to answer your question. The contract in numerous spots incorporates the governing documents. Mr. Miller, PFW's principal, testified at trial that he understood that what he was buying was a fractional interest, and he acknowledged receipt of the governing documents and acknowledged that his ownership interest was subject to those governing documents. So we would disagree that you look solely at the contract, because in this case, Your Honor, the contract, the interest being conveyed in the contract refers expressly to the declaration, and the contract expressly incorporates the other governing documents which implement this rotating reservation policy.
Well, as I understand it, Mr. Liffa, the interest, the fractional interest conveyed here is different from a timeshare interest where you might have the right to a specific unit, say, during the third week in February each year. Is that correct?
I think you've hit it right on the head, Your Honor. That's the key difference. And the case law that PFW relies on is it talks about traditional condos and traditional timeshares, like the ones you're describing, where you have a unit, and it is your unit for a specific portion of the year, and in that specific unit. That's absolutely not the case here. We're talking about a wholly different product. And I think Judge Boyd's order on that point is fairly explicit and goes into some good detail on his own factual findings. He refers to the testimony of my client's principal, Brooke Peterson, who testified that, most importantly, you're never guaranteed and you have no right to demand to be in your specific unit that you purchased, in this case, F7. There's no guarantee that Mr. Miller or PFW would ever use unit F7.
If you manage to say, buy out all the other fractional interest in F7, you couldn't then just stay in F7 year-round if you wanted. You would still be subject to this reservation system and could be placed wherever.
Yes, thank you, Your Honor. I think that's a great point, because you're not only using unit F7, you're using one of the 19 three-bedroom units, or you're using one of the 7 four-bedroom units. So even though you're on the contract for purposes of a deed and for purposes of title insurance and for purposes of transferability of the interest, says F7, under the declaration and the other governing documents that are incorporated into the contract, there is absolutely no right to use F7, and there is absolutely no guarantee that you would ever get to use that unit. And that is the problem, because as Judge Taubman pointed out earlier, it's not, the definition of lot is not just found in the regulations. It's expanded upon and defined in more detail in the guidelines. And the quote that you read earlier, Your Honor, is exactly correct, and it's in the guidelines. And as you referenced, it requires more than just what the regulations purport to require, which is a specific portion of the land. It goes further and says what you need for that second prong is exclusive possession of a specific designated lot. And it's important that it uses the word lot, because that means that the interest that you're claiming is a lot must be the same thing that you have the exclusive right to use. And that's not what PFW is arguing to the court in this case. They concede, from all I can tell, that they don't have exclusive right to use any particular unit. Their argument is that they have the right to use a specific unit type. And under the guidelines, that's simply not enough. In addition to the section that Judge Taubman quoted from, the guidelines go on to say that for purposes of definition, if the purchaser has been assigned a specific lot on a recurring basis for a defined period of time and could eject another person during the time he has the right to use that lot, then the purchaser has exclusive use. And that quote is talking about what exclusive use is. And again, it's saying that you have to have exclusive use of the same lot that you're claiming is a lot for purposes of ILSA definition. And again, that's not what PFW is claiming in this case.
Mr. Liffa, what is your response to Mr. Zurbich's comment that the guidelines are just advisory as opposed to the regulations themselves, and therefore even if this language, as you've been describing, is accurate, it doesn't necessarily govern?
Well, Your Honor, the guidelines are just that, they're guidelines. But in this case, when we're dealing with a matter of first impression, it's really all we have. We have what the agency thought, how the agency defined a lot, and that, as Judge Boyd noted in his orders, is entitled to deference. The only other authority we have on this kind of point is the Betcher case from the Sixth Circuit, which I think is also instructive. and not because it's on point exactly factually, but because of the analysis that the Sixth Circuit did in that case. What the Sixth Circuit did was it looked at what the district court had done in that case, and what the district court had done was to test the exclusive use of the units, and found that in that case, because of the restrictive covenants that were in place, and because of the commercial nature of the units, there wasn't exclusivity of use. And that's what the Sixth Circuit upheld in Betcher, was that analysis by the district court, and that's the same analysis that Judge Boyd conducted in our case that we feel is proper. He took a look at the use restrictions, and in abiding by the guidelines and the regulations two-prong test, examined what exclusive right, if any, PFW had, and based on the fact that they're never guaranteed to be in Unit F7, they simply have no exclusivity, and as Judge Boyd found, they fail that second prong of the test, the definition of a lot. And the last thing I'd say about that, in the guidelines, they give this campsite example. And as an introduction to the campsite example, the guidelines say, the sale of undivided interests that do not carry with them the right of exclusive use of a specific lot does not establish jurisdiction. That's how the guidelines introduce the campsite example. And then the campsite example, as you know from our briefs, is that when you have a coextensive, non-exclusive right to use all of the campsites on a space-available basis, but have no express or implied exclusive right to repeated use to any specific campsite, then the guidelines say you do not have a lot. With my remaining time, I want to quickly touch on the motion to vacate the arbitration award. This was a motion brought after the conclusion of the arbitration, and I think some factual background of the arbitration is important. PFW filed the arbitration. PFW filed it at the same time they filed a lawsuit. We did move to compel arbitration, but that was never ruled on by the court. Judge Boyd, in other cases involving other purchasers and similar contracts, said yes, under this contract, these are arbitrable claims. But in this case, there was no order to compel arbitration. The parties voluntarily agreed to submit their non-ILSA claims to arbitration. And when we got to arbitration, those non-ILSA claims included DORA claims of the very type that PFW is now alleging it knew nothing about. And this is the one point where I think the factual record is particularly important. On the eve of the arbitration hearing, PFW received a letter from DORA indicating that DORA didn't have certain submissions on file from RLND for a defined time period. That sent us scrambling immediately because this was never something that was pled, never anything like that. It was really on the eve of the arbitration. We asked for and were granted leave to file a supplemental pre-hearing brief on the very issue of DORA. And in that pre-hearing brief, which is in the record at page 331, you will see that we expressly address the very statutory claim that PFW is talking about here. And that's important for a couple of reasons. One, we think it was an issue that was discussed at the arbitration hearing and ruled on in RLND's favor by the arbitrator, Skip Netzor. But even if it wasn't addressed, even if this particular claim or this version of fraud wasn't addressed, we think PFW should be collaterally stopped from asserting it now. And the reason is this isn't a discovery rule issue. This isn't when they discovered the fraud. We're talking about RLND's registration status with DORA. It's a public entity and it's a public issue. These documents were available not from RLND, but from DORA at all times, and indeed that's how PFW eventually got them. And the law on collateral estoppel is clear. It bars not just relitigation of issues, but also bars a second action in which the claim should have been brought in the first place.
So, Mr. Liber, are you saying that registration issue was in fact raised at the arbitration proceeding?
It certainly, again, it's a little bit unclear because it definitely was not pled. But in the days leading up to arbitration, there was certainly a suggestion that PFW intended to pursue some sort of theory on violations of the subdivision rules, which include things of that nature. And as I said, the page I cited to you in the record is our supplemental pre-hearing brief, in which we expressly address this statutory claim pursuant to 1261-407 and why it doesn't apply, and why we feel we were duly registered at all times. And it's not specifically addressed in Arbitrator Netzor's order, other than to say all other claims are denied and I find in favor of RLND. So it's not crystal clear, but that's why the collateral estoppel issue is equally important. I see I'm out of time, so I'll conclude. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The court thanks both counsel for your excellent arguments, written and oral. Thank you very much. That concludes the submission to this case. It will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.